Welcome to Season 7 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Daniel Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
If you haven't heard, Allplay is expanding its roster with three new game lines. It's expanding beyond its traditional product constraints with the launch of three new game lines, including Masterworks, Epics, and Creations. For anyone who doesn't know what this is, Masterworks will focus on heavier Euro games, including a new partnership with renowned designer and artist Ian O'Toole, and a remake of Dominant Species. So check them out. Protospiel Chicago is back September 11th through the 13th in Countryside, Illinois. If you haven't heard of Protospiel, well, it's a weekend dedicated to tabletop game design and playtesting. Whether you're a designer looking to put your latest prototype through its paces or a gamer who wants to give input and feedback on new games to help shape them before they're published, Protospiel is the place to be. So come play, give feedback, meet designers, and help make great games even better. Find badges and more information at tabletop.events. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 149, Jewel Box. Today we are joined by Zach Loveless, game designer and owner of Love More Games. Thanks for being on the show.
I've listened to a lot of your podcast episodes and been playing Caution Signs for a while now, and so I'm really excited to join you today.
Aw, I'm so glad. Yeah, that was fun that you said you started listening because of Stable Times. Kristen is awesome. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I mean, she's been so influential for us as a company, and anytime I see her on a podcast episode or anything really, I watch it, and I love to support her because she's helped us so much.
That's awesome. I always love hearing that when it's like a designer-publisher relationship, that it's kind of symbiotic, because I feel like that's not always the case.
I think it definitely helps when we're newer too. You know, we've been in the industry now for just a few years, and so when someone like her, who's also fairly newish to designing, you know, we create this relationship, and it's just really cool to see we're doing this together. You know, neither of us a massive name yet, but to just see each other excited for each other is really helpful and just really motivating in the industry.
And what got you into designing games?
I mean, so I'm kind of one of those classic stories of like, ever since I was a kid, I loved playing games. My parents were kind of in that time period where it really was just like Catan and Puerto Rico and a few of those games that were kind of new. And they played with my aunt and uncle and friends and stuff. And once I was a teenager, I was finally old enough for them to be like, okay, you can now start playing games with us. But even when I started playing games with them, there were just certain little things about certain games that I was like, I think I could do better. And so I, as a kid, even would take face card decks and mess with them a little bit. But it wasn't until I was 20, 21, I started designing my very first game. But it was one of those things where I didn't know what to do really. You know, I didn't even really know who to connect with at that point. That was about 10 years ago. And so I just started making this game. And eventually, after about 4 years of really not knowing what to do, I met this guy while I was working at a bank who came in for a business loan, and he ran a game company here in Utah. And so I was able to connect with him. And about 6 months later, it's funny because he ended up reaching back out to me and offering me a position in his company. And so that's basically kind of where it started, is once I met him, I was like, okay, actually, like, I have a game kind of a thing, was able to pitch it to him, and we sold it. Didn't do super well, unfortunately, but we learned a lot through it. And so that's kind of how I got in the industry as well, is I had just had this dream and passion for a long time, and then ended up working for this small publisher for a few years.
And then you transitioned into owning your own company.
Yes. Yeah. So after a few years, he actually started looking at selling the company. And I originally had a non-compete. And so it was this weird thing where he was like, well, because I'm selling the company, like, maybe we'll just rip it up, basically, you know, and then you can start your own thing. And I was like super appreciative of that, because technically at the time, you know, I was still working for him and selling his games. And so for him to allow me to start my own thing while I was still working for him was really helpful, actually.
Yeah, I've had a few instances where I got like laid off due to financial issues. And then they're like, you know what? Every game you designed that we didn't make, you can just have it. And I'm like, really? I made this on work time. And they're like, yep, take it. I was like, what? Okay.
Oh, it makes such a big difference. Like, they're not legally bound to do that. You know, it's like they could do whatever they want with it. But it, just to have somebody, some publisher say that is, it means a lot.
Oh, totally. It helps with the sting of losing your job when it's like, well, at least I got all the ideas that I made up. I mean, yeah. You don't tend to get that.
You know, those are the type of things that going into creating my own publishing company really have impacted the way that I look at things too, right? Is it's like, just be good to people. It'll come back around to you as well. And even if it doesn't, like, you're doing the right thing and making a big impact.
Totally. I mean, what you put into the world hopefully will come back out for you.
Yeah.
In a good way, not a bad way. Yeah. Serial killery. Sorry, I'm still waking up.
I am too. love it.
Man. All right. Well, here we're talking about Jewel Box. That's one of your most popular games. Tell us, how was this game inspired and how do you play it?
When I first started Love More Games, I started it with the intention of being like, well, I just want to make my own games, basically. I made this other game. It did okay. It didn't do amazing. And then when I started designing more games, I was trying to find my voice, trying to figure out how I was going to be as a designer, and realized pretty quickly that I prefer finding a theme or some mechanic in the world before the gameplay. And the reason why is because of Jewel Box is why I kind of realized that. But I was scrolling Instagram one day, I think, and saw this picture. I don't even know who posted it, honestly, but of just these beautiful beetles. And I remember thinking, like, I've never seen beetles look this pretty. Like, I just think of the ones at home, you know, that are just brown and black and ugly and gross and whatever. But I saw these beautiful colored beetles. At the time, my wife's cousin, her name is Megan. She's been our illustrator for a lot of our games. So I kind of just reached out to her and I was like, hey, do you think you could draw like these pretty beetles? And she was like, for sure. And so that's where I was like, okay, well, she said she can do it. So let me find a game idea that can work with beetles. So instantly I started researching, you know, what do people do with beetles? Well, they're commonly collected, right? And so that kind of narrows down what type of game it can be. So then I looked into things like, well, where do you find beetles? Well, beetles are typically found under, in and around logs. And so that's why we have this log board in Jewel Box. It was really cool. I started listening to these podcasts about beetles. I mean, I feel like I've forgotten a little bit of it, but at the time, at least, you know, I was borderline an entomologist, you know, self-proclaimed. You know, once I started designing it too, I was like, okay, well, really, we're only going to have five different things here, five different ways to score. And so I could have just had the same beetle or whatever, but there's so many good games out there like Wingspan and whatnot that really show off the beauty of these different creatures. And so I had decided in the end that I wanted to have all unique beetles in it. And so there's 75 different beetles when really there's only five different things that score, just so I could show off the beauty of kind of the reason why I decided to make the game in the first place. And so that's kind of how it started.
That's really interesting. I feel like to be inspired by the beauty of something and to go for the collectability of it, just because I was previously in Arizona like last week from the time of recording, but I saw a ton of those like cases with the different butterflies displayed. And it's one of those like interesting moments of like, I feel a little sad about this, but also they're so beautiful and likely you'll never see all these different species in the real world. So it's kind of like nice to see them.
Yeah. And you bring up a good point, Danielle, because like I say, there's this little bit of a kind of this moral issue with like pinning beetles, right? Mm-hmm. And when we were designing the game, we kind of originally had the idea of pinning, but then we kind of decided to go away from that and just kind of leave it up to players' interpretation, whether you're pinning beetles or whether you're just collecting them kind of thing, you know, because I just feel like allowing it to be more to your interpretation or how you want to do it allows anyone to enjoy it however they want to kind of a thing, you know. But what's fun is because once we start diving into it, we're like, oh, there's actually more history besides just like the current way that people collect beetles and pin them. Back in the day, people would, in the Victorian era, they actually used to collect beetles and then they'd use them as jewelry. They used their shells. They put them on earrings or rings, or there's these really cool pictures from that time period where people, these ladies would pin the or sew these like beetle shells onto their dresses and stuff. It's just crazy what they used to do with beetles. But I remember looking into it and the reason why it ended up ending where we used real beetles as jewelry and whatnot is because of the moral issue, right? And that, and they talk about that in a lot of these historical things, you know. And so we actually have a little snippet about the history and kind of why it ended, why the jewelry part of beetles ended, in the back of the rule book, just to kind of show people like, this is what happened, but like, this is why it's not there anymore, you know. And just for me, I don't necessarily want to make educational games. Like, I feel like if a game is meant to be educational, it's usually not that fun. But if you can almost tie this like history or educational aspect into a game, but not make that the main focus, you can allow certain people that enjoy that to have that moment with your game that is really special for them and to learn about whatever it is the game is about. But you can also have it just be fun for everyone too.
No, that's really cool. I know when I worked at Underdog Games, our motto was like, inspires curiosity. So working on like Her Story or any of the National Geographic games, it was one of these things where it was like, these are not educational games, but you can learn from them. And on the back of every card, there was information. So it's like, you could choose to ignore it or you could interact with it, which was really nice. Cause I guess passively learning things. Like, I'm not intentionally trying to read a textbook, but hey, now I've just read 120 cards about amazing women through history by playing Her Story. So it's like, cool.
I love it. And I mean, that's why I think one of the reasons why Wingspan will stand the test of time is because of that. You know, I played botany for the first time several months ago and felt the same way with the cool flowers that you're collecting and stuff. You know, it doesn't feel like this is an educational game, you know, but I love that I can walk away from board gaming feeling like I'm learning something rather than playing a sport or something. Not to say that I can't play sports too, but it's just like, it feels like I'm learning, like I'm growing in knowledge as well. I love that. I love that about games. And I think nowadays it's a lot more common, those type of things.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think we've gotten better at having more diverse types of mechanics and themes and games and art styles. And I think that's awesome just because I personally was getting bored of the same fantasy and trance.
Yeah, I know. For me too, like, I love a good pirate game or a good, you know, I don't know, dragon themed game or whatever. But like, when you can like play a game that is about some real world topic, you know, whether it's Beatles or whether it's women's rights, like Her Story and stuff, those are really cool opportunities to learn about something that I would have otherwise not learned about potentially. You could take any pirate game and potentially put another theme on it and it'd still work. And I'm not saying, you know, people out there shouldn't do more pirate games or whatever, but I just love the idea that really you could take a bunch of different, you know, ideas and themes and tie them to most designs, you know, and there's going to be some that will work better than others, but I just think there's cool opportunities to learn about stuff. So,
oh, totally. And for Jewelbox, how do you play and how did you incorporate the different types of Beatles as the set collection or scoring, I guess?
Just real quick overview. So Jewelbox, you are collecting these Beatles from a log. To do that, you roll a 6-sided dice. So there's 5 spots on the log. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 that just correlate with the 5 sides of the dice, and then the 6th side of the dice, if you roll that on the log board, it just says you can pick any of the 5 that are face up. And it's interesting because it's one of those things where it is luck based, and I've had a lot of comments about from people that's the aspect I don't like about it, which is fine, you know, in the end there's a game for everyone kind of a thing, right? But for me, as a pretty big gamer myself, my wife actually is kind of the one that pushed to have it be a little bit more luck based because she wanted it to be a little bit more accessible potentially to mass market as well. But even relating it back to like us as gamers, I liked it because, like, for example, like Carcassonne or any like game that has a deck of cards, right? You're just kind of drawing, playing. Yeah, right. And it's luck based too. Granted, with Carcassonne, there's a big map that you're building, so there's a lot of possibilities of where you can place it, and that's the fun of it and stuff. But with Jewelbox, it's this cool thing where it's like, I roll dice 1 through 5, I just get what I get. But then there's this cool opportunity where when I do get a 6, then I can't take anything. Or we also have these little tools. One of them is a magnifying glass tool that you can use once per game that can let you take in a beetle from the log. So again, those are things where if you just had a face down deck or whatever, you wouldn't be able to incorporate some of these things where you can look at certain options that are face up and take one of them and be able to use it as well. But like Carcassonne and stuff, this game, Jewelbox, is more about where you place your beetle that you collect rather than what you pick, right? And so after you pick your beetle, you're going to be placing it in front of you, adjacent to a beetle that's already in front of you, up to a 4x4 grid. So it's kind of like a King Domino type thing where all the pieces have to connect that you're playing down in front of you, and then you are maxed out at that 4x4 grid. We do have a variation with 2 players where you can go up to a 5x5 grid, just add a little more space, but it's the same gameplay. The beetles all score just depending on how they're placed, and so certain ones, we have weevils that are the red color, and they just score by being in a straight line. Whereas ladybugs, this is kind of fun, actually. Ladybugs in real life eat each other and eat other insects, but they'll eat each other, which is kind of crazy. And so because of that, we actually decided that ladybugs would score by not being adjacent to each other. So every ladybug that's not touching another one scores. They don't do it just normally, but they will do it if they need to, like for survival and stuff. And so there was like certain things that we tried to make as real, like scarabs. So scarabs they're a green color, and the scarabs themselves are kind of like one of the most well-known type of beetles. You know, if you think about like ancient Egyptian times.
I was thinking the Mummy movie. Yeah, exactly. So right now, the like scenes where they go under the skin and it freaked me out.
Right, it's freaky, but yeah, that like you think about scarabs, you think about like royalty, kind of oftentimes, and so we have or the scarabs scoring where if every single insect adjacent to it is a different color or a different type, I should say, then it scores. And so it's kind of like the royal one where it has all of the other ones around it and stuff. And so we really tried to make every single insect type
thematic to how they actually work in real life.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not perfect, you know, but some of them do work like that. And so we wanted to make it, again, like we're talking about, like I wanted it where if an entomologist played this, they're like, dang, this is fairly accurate to like my life, you know, like what I do and stuff, but also not be so apparent and educational that it's a turnoff for other people. But yeah, so that's basically how you play the game. Like I said, you have a few tools like the magnifying glass, picking beetle from the log. You have tweezers, which will let you swap two different beetles in front of you. And then once you get to those 16 insects, the game's over and you count up points. Each of those tools though, there's those two tools, and then there's just one extra that's either, like I can use it as a magnifying glass or as a tweezers. Each one you don't use at the end of the game is two bonus points. So there's obviously incentive to not just use them all every game. But then, yeah, you count points and then you see who wins at the end. So the nice thing about it is this is like with two players, let's say it's like a 15 to 20 minute game. And so I'll play with a lot of people who are like, oh, that was fast. Like, let's do another one and we'll do best of three or whatever, you know? So it's a nice quick game that you can, you know, fill in short times or maybe before or after a big heavy game as well, you know, so.
That's really interesting. And so then what kind of changes happened during playtesting and developing the game?
Yeah, that's a great question. Again, I kind of wanted this to be a little bit more strategic, maybe. Not to say that there's not strategy, but like a little bit less luck. It went through a lot of different iterations over about a year-ish time span. But the one that I was playtesting the longest was pretty similar to what we had here. I had seven different insect types, though, instead of five. And then we also had two boards instead of one. And so, like, for example, we just have the log board that's one through five, and then the six is anything. But I had two boards. One of them was a mini log, and one of them was like a little leaf. And each one had one through three, and then the dice at that point was just one through three, basically. And so if I rolled one, I could pick the one from the leaf or the one from the log. If I rolled two, I could pick either or. And it's funny because, like, for a while, I was like, that was fun for me. But then, you know, when I started playtesting it with more people, especially, like, my family, some of the family members who aren't as, you know, into the deeper games, when we started playing testing with those people, they were like, it almost feels like you can just get what you want too often. And then when you're getting what you want too often, it's almost not as fun because you're building your perfect tableau every time. And so that's where my wife was the one again that said, let's just get one log, one through, you know, we do all the numbers of the dice, one through six. And then we have that one space that's the get anything you want, the number six. Then again, it's funny because when we started playtesting it, I was pretty hesitant. Even to the point where like we started playtesting with people and people were like, I like this better. And I was still so convinced as a designer, and I had this original idea. I was like, no, like, why do you guys like this? Like, I like the leaf and the log, you know? And it took me a while. Like, once it finally got out and we started selling it, really was the first time when influencers and stuff started talking about it and playing it that I was like, okay, I think we made a good decision. Because, you know, it is one thing when you have playtesters, but it's another thing when you finally get it out into the public and just see random people playing it and giving thoughts about it. I feel like I had a little bit of this, like, I trusted my playtesters, and that's why we made the decision to change it a little bit from how I had it. But it was still a little nerve-wracking because I was like, I just still think it was better the old way, you know? I don't know if have you ever had that? Am I crazy in that feeling? Or like, you know, where a game goes to print and you're like, I kind of liked it the other way, but we'll see. And then it grows on you.
It definitely has happened to me, but a lot of times it was out of my control at that point because the publisher kind of took it and made a choice to like fit. And sometimes I was right and sometimes I was wrong, or sometimes it kind of fell into the neutral zone. But I've definitely done it with like early prototypes where I felt very strongly that I had a decision that was going to be great. And then when I played it, I was like, oh, okay. So like really depending on what audience this game is for is whether or not I'm right. Because I do play tests a lot with like people like my parents or people that are kind of at their level of really not playing many games, and you have to be very slow to teach, and it takes a few times to like really grasp the rules. And so something as like a more elevated like Uno type game could be very difficult for them and take a while to like grasp, where if you played them with like literally anyone who goes to like a Gen Con, they'd be like, oh, this game is too easy. So it's like this weird in between of like, well, who is your audience? Because that would change how this game should be played. Because it sounds like for you, you were going for a more accessible game by doing the dice rolling. Also, like, part of the strategy in what you're doing in your game is very much like, hey, I've been given this thing. Where do I put it to kind of mitigate, like, or try to figure out how to score it best as you're decreasing the amount of options because you have that 4x4 grid. That is similar to like if you had a Carcassonne level game where you're drawing one tile and you have to place it, or you're looking at two things, or you're doing pick and pass. Like, there's a lot of different ways to draft, but at least in this way, because especially since you like focusing on the art, you're able to look at all your options when you're rolling and be like, oh, well, hopefully I'll get this other one later on. But yeah, so it's interesting. It really depends on like who you're trying to make this game for.
Yeah, I'm glad that I'm not alone in that,
no,
at least.
No. I'm sure you can find most of the people who have been on the show would agree with you that this has happened.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, but I 100% agree. Like, I've gotten to the point now where like I really do appreciate the way that it ended up. I play it now with my wife or family members or whatever, and I really enjoy it now, and I'm glad that we did it the way that we did. And I do feel like, even though you do have the occasional, you know, BGG user that's like, oh, this sucks because of the dice roll or whatever, you know, it's like, for the most part, I think people understand it. Like you're saying, like, they understand that it's just one way that you draw tiles at random. You know, it could have been any other way, like you're saying, but I think people appreciate that it at least works. It's really all about how you place it, right? And at the beginning of the game, you just put one in front of you, and then you're building off of it. So at the beginning, you have very limited options. And by the end of it, you have very limited options. And in the middle, you have a lot of options. And it ends up being this really cool puzzle. You know, I definitely feel like it's a cozier, puzzly type game. And so if you want like a little cozy game, it's kind of perfect for that.
Yeah. And what made you decide to make that like a game you wanted to self-publish?
That's a really good question, Danielle. I was already kind of had decided I was going to self-publish no matter what, you know, and so it was really just finding that game, as all designers are, you know, working on potentially 5 to 10 games on the high end, at least for me. And so I was working on other games, and they were just not my favorite for XYZ reason. I don't know why, but again, when I saw those Beatles, I just loved them. You know, we actually have this little museum in Utah called the Butterfly Biosphere, and I went over there, and you know, you just go into this little area and there's just tons of butterflies everywhere, and you know, they'll land on you, and then they have like a little beetle section too. And just going there, I was just like, these are incredible. Like, I don't know what it was, but there was just something about the beauty of it that I just really wanted to make, you know. And again, I was working on so many other games, and the themes were okay, obviously, and there's still ones that I'm working on to this day. For whatever reason, it was just the beauty of those Beatles. And then I guess besides that, like pretty soon after I was looking into that theme, I had a pretty playable prototype that I felt pretty good with. And so it just kind of made sense at that point. If the gameplay was working out decently well and I loved the theme, it was like, okay, let's just go all in on this, basically. So
personally, I'm a huge fan of Jewelbox as the name. And I have a guess as to why you named it that, but talk more about the naming of that. Also your company's name.
Yeah. So I can do both. I'll start with Love More Games, actually, but me and you, Danielle, we were laughing about this a little bit earlier, but there's kind of two things for Love More Games. I mean, first is the obvious. So my last name is Loveless. And so I thought Loveless Games would be a little sad as a game publisher name. You know, it was like, okay, well, what's another name that's kind of similar to our last name? We'll Love More Games. And the more we thought about it, though, like we were kind of just joking at the beginning about it. If I was like, you know, divorce lawyer or something, I think Loveless Attorney or whatever would be great. But because I'm in the game world, you know, we got to go something different. And the more we thought about it, we're like, what's also kind of fun about Love More Games is it just is, it's just this word that kind of is like, if I'm creating games that are like Love More Games, like games that get you to love more games, they're almost like gateway games a little bit. You know, like gateway games are ones that get people into the hobby, that get them enjoying more games. It kind of worked well with the type of games that I wanted to make, which were more of like these gateway type games, you know, games that like, so here in Utah, we go to a lot of these conventions and stuff that aren't game conventions. They're like these local family events, let's say. And the games actually sell, a lot of our games sell really well there, but especially Jewelbox sells really, really well at these events, because when people see them, they're like, this is simple enough for me to grasp as like a casual gamer, but it's beautiful and something I like, I'm not used to seeing, you know, versus like all the other card games and party games that I've played. And anyways, so that's kind of what we focused on, is like these gateway-y type games, you know, not to say that I tying myself down to one type long term, but I think for now that's kind of what we're focusing on. So that's kind of a little bit of a history on the company name. As far as Jewelbox, what's funny is me and Kristen laugh about it now, but we originally landed on the name Insectarium for this game. If anyone listening knows, Kristen Mott made a game called Insectarium. We actually landed on that name. You know, we always do these checks when we are making a new game. You know, we look up on USPTO, the trademark search, to see if there's a trademark for it. We look on Board Game Geek. And if we don't see it on either of those, then we try to look on like Instagram or socials, you know, to see if somebody's like posted something with that name that they're even working on. And we found Kristen Mott's game in September. Like, she had announced it literally like a few weeks potentially before we before we decided on this name. And so we were getting to the point where like my artist was starting to design the cover of the box, and depending on, you know, what name we were going with, it was going to change the look of the game. And so we were like, okay, start doing this. But then I was just like looking through, and I ended up stumbling upon, I think I just looked up Insectarium like in the search bar of Instagram and ended up finding it somehow, like Kristen's post about it. And so I was like, oh no, are you serious? Looking into it, I saw that she was doing a Kickstarter coming up, and then we're like, okay, well, I guess we have to pivot. It was like, it was kind of a bummer because we were like starting to get into that part of the game where we actually had to change a few things. Like even the tiles are slightly different now because of the name change. We started looking up stuff. We ended up meeting this, which it ended up being, I love the name in the end, and I'm glad we went with it. But we ended up meeting this girl who is not an official entomologist, but she's basically one. She's kind of a self-proclaimed entomologist. She's kind of a bug influencer. So she lives in Utah. We met up with her through, it was actually a mutual friend that ended up connecting us. And when we started talking to her, she was telling us some of the history. And that's when she brought up like the Victorian era time period of beetles. And, you know, when you're thinking about like jewelry and stuff, you know, the idea came up of like, oh, well, you know, maybe they kept like their beetle jewelry in jewelry boxes or whatever. And at the time, we actually had one of the five beetle types is called jewel beetles. That's just like the type of beetle that family is called. So when we were thinking of like the story that she told us about this Victorian era of collecting beetles, then we started getting thinking about like jewelry box. I don't know. We just eventually got to the point where like jewel box, like with the name of the beetle being a jewel beetle, you know. Then we like talked to her again. We're like, okay, we thought of this name, and she was literally like in love with it. She was like, this is so cool. We actually referenced her name in the very back of the rule book because she was super influential in actually helping fact check all the beetles. Because we actually have a little map, kind of like Wingspan, where it shows where each beetle's found in the world. We have like the scientific name, the common name, the family information, everything. Like it's very detailed with the information that's on it. And so we wanted to make sure it's all accurate. So she fact checked it and everything. But that's anyway, so it's just this funny thing that it all started out with Insectarium. Because it didn't work out, we ended up looking into other names, and then it became Jewelbox. And because of the name Jewelbox that we decided on, that's what prompted us to make the box look more like a little jewelry box that, you know, and I really love how it turned out in the end. And it's funny because, you know, when Kristen was pitching us Stable Times and stuff, when we first met her and we're talking to her, I like told her this story about Insectarium, and we just had a good laugh about it. But we both ended up launching those games around the same time, Insectarium and Jewelbox, which are both beetle games. They're played differently, but there's some similarities, right? We ended up being able to laugh about it, and that's kind of one of the things that we first connected on with Kristen. And, you know, it's just fun to think about, you know, the girl that we just randomly saw that was making this Insectarium game ended up being one that we're working with really closely now. But yeah, that's kind of a history of how it came to be then, the name of it at least. So
yeah, no, I think that's such a fun story. And for me, I was guessing that it had to do with the jewelry aspect and how people use especially beetles as like brooches. And I also love that you did do your little butterfly expedition, the fluttering expedition one, because I'm a huge butterfly fan. Anytime I see one, I think of my aunt who passed away, because that was like her animal, her symbol.
I think butterflies are kind of the most liked insect for the most part, right? They're pretty, they're you know, they're not really dangerous or anything like that. And so what's interesting, Danielle, that you bring up the expansion is that looking you kind of into the history of when we were making the game, when I was talking about when I first was making it, I had seven different beetle types, not just five. When I started looking at manufacturing it, the cost to have, I think it was, so we have the 75 in the base game, so there's 15 per type, per family. And then, so there was 30 more, so it was 105 tiles. The cost ended up being just barely more expensive than I had hoped. Not barely, it was a little more expensive than I had hoped, but just to the point where I was like, I might have to price this a little bit more expensive than I originally wanted to. And but the reason why we had the seven types is because I really wanted the game to play up to six people. And so we ended up deciding to make this decision of like, well, what if we did an expansion, which in the end ended up technically being more expensive because then it's a whole new box and everything. For me, it was more about the price of it. I was like, if I don't have those 30 tiles and the extra cards and pieces or whatever, then I can make this the original game, even though it's only up to four people, it'll be at the right price point that I wanted it. And so then the expansion was, we actually launched it at the same time. And so we were able to make the original box the right size to be able to fit all the components from the expansion, which is really nice. So that's always one of our pitches whenever we're around, is like, hey, you don't have to carry around both boxes if you get both of them. So that's where we kind of made that decision, is I still wanted to have those seven insect families, and I had really fun, like what I felt like really fun scoring conditions for all seven. And so then when we were thinking about, we're like, okay, well, let's make it an expansion instead. For the people that want to get it, they can. And if they don't, then they can just get the base game, and that's great. But then, you know, we were like, okay, well, we can't just make another expansion that's just beetles. We could technically, but we were like, oh, let's do something else. Like, people love butterflies, you know? And so then that's where we ended up doing butterflies, and which also, like, beetle, like, out of all the insect types out in the world, beetles have the most unique families, different types of beetles out of any insect on the whole planet. And with butterflies, oh, I can't remember exactly, but I think there's only like 5 to 7 different families of butterflies, and then obviously within each family there's a bunch of different types. And so we're like, okay, well, that's perfect, because there's only a few types anyways, and or families, and we can just pick a few for the expansion. And then it's an expansion that allows up to 6 players to play, and then also just has some other scoring options. Even if you don't have 6 players, if you have, you know, just 2 of you playing or whatever, you can just mix in the butterflies and be able to mix up, you know, the games that you're playing with the different scoring options.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm glad that it worked out.
Yeah, I know. I'm glad too. It's always scary when you're like getting into later stages of game development and realize there's something similar, whether it be a name or gameplay. That's just the joys of the industry we're in. When there's so many different games coming out now, it's like you're bound to have some similarity at some point, you know, and you just have to be able to pivot if needed, or if not, be confident that your game is going to do well despite having another beetle game come out around the same, or whatever, you know. It's like it's just the nature of the business, and it's just how it's gonna be. But it's exciting that there's so many games coming out that there would be that even happening, you know.
My publisher from DVC, Jono, told me this like funny story about going to Philly trying to find like a Philly cheesesteak, and so went to this one location that said it was the best in Philly, and the place across the street said they were the first. And so they ended up having both, like, all of the coworkers had both, and it was just, like, interesting. They felt motivated to try both things, even though one claimed to be the best and the other claimed to be the first. So it's, like, which is actually more important, to be the first? Like, if you're Dominion, you're the first deck builder, or are you the best deck builder? Who knows? But the nice thing is people want to try them both.
No, I think that's the cool thing. Like, I like to tell a lot of people, you know, we're in this really unique industry where, not to go into too much, but like, unfortunately, the publishing side of this, of Lovemore, isn't my full-time job. I'm, you know, we're in the growth phase where we're reinvesting money into it to hopefully make it be that one day. But for now, I still have another job, and I kind of help run the Amazon side of different businesses and stuff. And it's funny because I work with a lot of these businesses. Like, let's just take like a broom company or something. You really only need one broom in your house. Like, maybe you have one for outside and one for inside or something, you know, but like, or a mop or something. You really just need like one in your house, right? And so as these different brands create these different products, it's really like, that's really important. You know, it's like, mine's the best because of this reason. Mine's the best because of this reason. I just love that we're in this industry where we can all coexist and there's a place for all of us. It's similar to like the movie industry where it's like, you know, you're not watching the same movie over and over. You might have a favorite, right? And you might watch that more than others, but there is a place for every movie. And that's why, you know, you keep going back to the movie theater when your next favorite movie comes out and whatnot, and you buy it afterwards, or you rent it, or you have Netflix and you're rewatching it. That's the same kind of industry we're in. We're in an entertainment industry where there's a reason why all of our bookshelves have a million games on them, because it's okay. You know, like, I tell people, I'm like, even if you play some of these games one or two times, you're getting your money's worth. Like to be completely honest, you know, like, yeah, if you play it 50 times, you're going to way get your money's worth. Even if I watch a movie at the movie theater for 10, 20 bucks or whatever, like I'm getting, like, it's kind of the same concept, right? And so it's just such a cool industry where I feel like, yeah, you could be the first, you could claim you're the best, you could claim this or that. But like in the end, regardless, you're making a game that fits on the shelf with all the other games out there, and there's a place for it, you know, and so there are going to be games that'll stand the test of time, that'll be evergreen games and whatnot. But in the end, it's like, let's just make games, and like, it's fun, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's just such a cool industry.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know people that buy basically every cat game that comes out. There's a lot of those. So, I mean, if you're a fan of space games, a fan of train games, a fan of whatever theme, go for it. Or if you're someone who's super into like nature and animals, like that's my sister. The only strategy game she owns that I didn't design are nature-based games. So it has like parks and New York Zoo or Cascadia. That's like the only ones that she's interested in playing. And it's like, she's really good at playing games. Like she beats me at every game I teach her pretty much. But the only ones that she feels motivated to keep in her like small apartment are these beautiful nature games and party games.
That's so cool. I think I heard you've said this before, Danielle, but it's like, how cool is it that we just are in this time where there is a theme for basically everything? Like, no matter what you're into, there's likely a game that's themed on it. And, you know, like, there, I feel like we're still to the point where there's, like, a million different animal species out there, and there's not a game for every animal species, but we're getting to the point where there's some games around, like, pretty unique animals, you know? Like, I even think about, like, the mantis shrimp and Exploding Kittens and, like, mantis or whatever, you know?
I was going to say, I did record an episode on that if you want to check it out. It's in, like, the third or fourth season, but it's really fun with Jeremy and Ken.
Oh, sweet. I'll have to go back and listen. But anyways, if you think about it, like, even though sometimes I feel like I'll hear people say that the industry is pretty saturated, I still think we're so far away from how saturated it could potentially be. But yeah, I love it. It's just, and I can tell you do, and we all do, right? Like, that's why we're in it. It's not probably the most lucrative industry in the world, but like, who cares when we're making games?
I completely agree. And how long do you think it took from the initial idea of this game to being printed and out for players to enjoy?
Yeah, so it took about a year from like concept to having it actually like online on Amazon and stuff selling. So, which means, you know, manufacturing plus shipping and stuff is, you know, 3 to 4 months minimum usually to like do that process. And then, you know, another 6 to 8 months or so of development. But to be fair, I wasn't working on it every day or whatever. Like, I actually think I remember there was about 3 or 4 months in between, or maybe even 5 months. We didn't have like any progress. Like, I actually felt like I kind of hit a brick wall with a couple of things that weren't working out. And, you know, during that time, I was working on other games. If you take out those 3, 4 or so months, you know, I probably had a couple months before that were pretty consistent. And then another couple few months after that. And, you know, for us being a kind of a brand new publisher, that was Jewelbox was our second game we came out with. You could move a little bit faster, you know, when you're a smaller publisher, and especially because we were having my wife's cousin do the illustrations, you know, and she lives fairly close. It was just like, hey, come on over, let's play test the game, and then let's start working on art. You know, it's a really good process, but also not a sustainable long-term process. They're like, you know, we're kind of getting to the point now where we're realizing those kind of timelines. At least like when you're starting art and then printing it and everything, or we're trying to start getting ahead of things a little bit more. It was a pretty quick process. Like, I actually, so we, when we launched our very first game, which is a waffle themed game called Top Waffle, it came out, and I actually started working on Jewelbox before we even launched that, which for me, in my mind, I was just like, I don't even care if Top Waffle does well or not. Like, I'm just like going to make games kind of a thing. You know, that's where my mind was. And so I had already started on it before then. And then that was part of the reason why in the middle, it was a little bit delayed too, is just because we launched it. And then it was like, there's just a lot when you launch a new game, and especially as a brand new company, trying to do a lot of these giveaways and influencer things and whatever to try to get the word out. And so it was, you know, probably active, like playtesting, designing. It was 4 to 5 months. And then towards the end of the design process, that's when our artist started. And then at that point, you know, we sent it over to the manufacturer and then got it a few months later.
And did you have a favorite and least favorite part of this experience of designing the game?
Yeah, that's a great question. I, Danielle, have realized I have a hard time with playtesting. It's not because I don't enjoy the process or whatever, but it's like, I just have a hard time like finding people and in like feeling bad that I keep asking my family to play my games. You know what I mean? And to be fair, like I'm getting to the point where I'm, you know, we're getting a better process with that. And a lot of it's through TTS now rather than in person. I love making games. I think it's so fun. I love the creative process of it. And not to say that I'm like weak or anything, you know, but then you finally show it to somebody and then they're like, it sucks. And you're like, great. And I've also realized, as most designers do, you know, it's like a lot of the feedback you get, especially if you get like, let's say you're playing with 5-6 different people, it's possible that all 5 or 6 of them are giving you different feedback. And you're like, what am I supposed to do? You say it's bad. And so to be able to go back and like filter that process, it's like all the parts of designing a game, it's the part I'm like still learning the best, you know, it's the part that I feel like I'm still learning, like how to decipher the feedback, when to like apply it, you know. And again, to be fair, like I've come out with the Waffle game that was my design, and then Top Waffle, and then Jewel Box. Then the other games we've done have been from designers, and then I'm going to be doing one that's for next year. So I'm still newish to designing personally. And again, so that's why I'm like kind of still learning this process. But like for whatever reason, it was easier to like playtest Stable Times or the new game that we're doing from Kristen later this year, you know, like because I guess it's like I didn't see it from conception per se. You know, I saw it at a much later stage when it had already been playtested a bunch of times, and it was like nearing a more final stage, and so where it's more like just fine-tuning things, you know, whereas it's like you play test it the very first time when you come up with an idea and it's like, oh, it's so brutal, you know, and then it's like, okay, now you do it again and it's like, oh dang, it's still brutal, like what am I doing, you know. And back to your question, it's like I would say that that's something that I'm learning and I'm getting better at, but it was probably like the hardest, especially like when I was mentioning how I had certain aspects of the game that changed, you know, it's like I got to the point where I was just like, I trust you guys. And so we're going to go with it this way, even though I kind of wanted to go this way and kind of putting my pride aside and going that route. That was kind of hard, you know, as far as like my favorite kind of part of the process, I like learning about stuff. Like I don't know if it's my ADHD or whatever, but like, I just really enjoy learning about everything. That's why with Jewel Box, like just listening to these podcasts, talking to this girl that was this bug influencer and stuff. And I just enjoy bugs now. And I didn't before, you know, and it's like, even for example, like next month, I'm going to this event in Utah called Bug Fest, and I'm going to be selling Jewel Box at Bug Fest. You know, like I've like really kind of like gotten into the, like trying to put Jewel Box in the bug world with people and stuff. And it was really fun. Like I would listen to these podcasts and then I was like, okay, like how do I incorporate that into the game? And it was like this really cool challenge and puzzle. And then to be able to see the final version and see how closely related and accurate it is to how Beatles are actually collected and all these different facts about the Beatles was really, really satisfying. Like my wife at one point, especially right when we first made the game and we'd play it, I'd be like, did you know that this beetle does this, or this beetle can grow up to this size? Like I would just remember these. I didn't remember facts about all 75 beetles, but I remembered a lot of facts that I had learned. And she'd be like, just be quiet, I just want to play the game, you know. You know, we were just joking obviously, but like it was just one of those things where it was funny because like I loved the product that I made in the end, you know, and I loved that I was able to like incorporate so much real facts and stuff, and I just loved what product we came out with. And so anyways, that was, yeah, that's kind of the things I enjoyed and didn't about the process.
That's amazing. I feel like figuring out how to abstract nature almost as if it was an IP and put it into a game is such a fun way to design, because you are looking at things trying to figure out, like for Wingspan, how do you relate what a bird is eating into like however many categories you have, and then like how much they eat or how much they do this. And I think that is a very interesting way to think versus like, I don't know, if you have the IP for Marvel and it's like, okay, well, how does Spider-Man work? It's like, well, he has these abilities and then he's going to attack for this much, but like comparing him to Thor, like how strong actually is he? So it's like, it's always fun to look at anything you're trying to design, whether it's the real world or like an intellectual property, and figure out how to capture that creature or that person for the type of mechanics you've chosen for your game.
Yeah. I mean, and to that point too, it's like, I've had to come to the conclusion that like in all game design, there's times where you have to stretch the truth a little bit potentially, you know, cause it's like, it's just not going to work so perfectly as it does the real thing in real life, you know? But like, for example, Spider-Man or something, you could potentially, I mean, you can't really stretch it too much because there are like the mega fans that'll be like, he can't do that. You know what I mean?
I mean, that's why they made a new Spider-Man, Miles Morales.
True. Exactly. They're like, well, just wait. We got another Spider-Man that can do that. You know, I do feel like you have a little more freedom with things like that, where you can just be like, yeah, well, of course Spider-Man can do that. He can lift a bus, you know, whatever. So he can do this or whatever, you know, and there's a little bit more room where designers can stretch that a little bit. But yeah, you're right. It's like, I was working on this bee themed game forever, and I haven't touched it in years, but like, you know, it was just, I was doing this as a very similar thing where I was like, how do bees work? You know, and there's several bee games out there. And I think that's kind of why I put it to the side for a little bit, but like, our world works so well already, you know, different things already do, you know, like beetles, like the way that they collected beetles in the past, like it already works a really cool way. Why not gamify it, you know, and or whatever thing is out there, you know, like I'll hear about a random creature that I've never heard of before, and I'll be like, that's really cool. Like, how can I make a game about it? You know, and I have this little game journal where I like write something down and hopefully one day revisit it. I don't know. That's just how I am as a designer, at least. It's just, I see these real world stuff and I think how to gamify it.
Yeah, I'm very, very similar. And then do you have any other projects that people should be looking out for?
So I'll give a little plug for a couple games. They're not my personal designs, but they're from Kristen Mott. And it's funny because you mentioned earlier the cat themed games, but we have an expansion to Stable Times coming out in a few months. And it's called the Barn Cats expansion. When Kristen pitched it to me, I loved the idea because it is very common in stables and barns and stuff to have cats that take care of the mice, you know, to kind of keep it clear of mice, especially because horses get very startled from mice and stuff. So that's kind of the theme of the game, is you have these little cats and you're going to be trying to clear the barn, the stables of the mice. It's just this cute little expansion that, you know, doesn't change the main core gameplay loop of Stable Times, but it just adds in this really fun kind of side gameplay element while you're still doing the horses. So anyways, that's really fun. And then we do have a new game that is designed by Kristen and actually illustrated by Ammon Anderson of like Gnome Hollow and stuff. So that game is called Saguaro Valley. It's kind of based off of like the saguaro cacti that grows like in Arizona and stuff. They're just these really cool cactus that, you know, are like homes to creatures, you know, like they, like these birds will like live inside of them, and then these little creatures and stuff, and they'll grow flowers and plant. Like, it's like a little ecosystem in and of itself, like this little habitat. And so Kristen, anyways, that it's her design again, and that one will be coming out around the same time as the Barn Cats expansion in a few months, a little bit early Q4. Kristen will actually have both of those games at Gen Con this year to kind of show off and pitch, and or not pitch, but show off to people and play with them. And so those ones are for this year, 2026. We do actually have two and potentially a third game that'll be for 2027, but we will announce and talk about those in a little bit.
Totally works for me. And then for my last question of the podcast, if you could have been the designer of a game you didn't design, which one would you have chosen?
I love it. I love this question. So my answer to this is my favorite game. The reason why is because when I first was introduced to this game, I was amazed at like the idea that this designer took kind of this classic game and just used it as like one element of this new game. But anyways, the game is Five Tribes. So by Bruno Cathala and published by Days of Wonder. I don't know that I would have been able to design this game because I think it's so well done. But the reason why I'm using it as the answer is because he took Moncala and used it as a core element of this bigger, broader game of summoning genies to help you with these abilities and, you know, just like collecting these cards and stuff. But like when I first played it, I was hooked and I was like, that's genius. Like you took this concept that has existed for who knows how long, you know, this pick up all the pieces and drop one at a time, and you made it so much cooler. And I was like, you know, a lot of times when I'm sitting down and designing, you know, I'm not always thinking of like, oh, like that Catan element or that whatever element, like that's really cool, but like how can we use it in something else or whatever. And I don't know how directly he thought like I'm using Moncala. I'm sure there was something there, I'm guessing, but like just seeing that opened my eyes to so many more possibilities as a designer. You know, and nobody would ever play that and be like, you just copied Moncala either. You know what I mean?
No. Yeah, it's a piece of it, but it's like the core of how you're doing what you need to do on your turn.
Exactly, right? And so that's where I'm like, you know, I think sometimes, you know, there are games where you're like so close to something else, you know, and that's not me. And I don't want to ever do that. You know, I don't want to be like, oh, I want to just make a better code names or whatever, you know, like but I'm also just like, dang, like that element, that specific part of that game is so cool, especially being a classic game like Moncala. It was so cool to me. Like, just again, it's one of my favorite games to this day. And anyways, I love Bruno Cathala and his games that he's designed and stuff as well. But like, it's just one of those where, you know, to answer your question, I don't know if I would have been able to design that. I hope, like, I maybe could have, but like, for me, it's more of just the concept of like, man, I wish I thought like that. You know what I mean? Of just like being able to extract these ideas from these classic games, like take Battleship or Sorry or whatever, and be like, is there one element of that that's really cool, and how do I incorporate that into something new?
I have to do that a lot for when I have a day job, especially working in mass market. It's like, do this but with this, or like, how do you change this thing that does really well but make it new?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a reason why things are classic, right? I don't know, it's like, take inspiration from what works, you know, but without copying it either. You know, there's a fine line there, but like, you know, I just think that there are so many things that work, like you said, in like mass marketing stuff, in the classics, but also there's a lot of things that just work in nature, in life, you know? And it's like, how do you take all those things together and make a beautiful game, a beautiful product, you know? And that's like with this new game, Saguaro Valley by Kristen, you know, it's like, for her, it was like, what are these cactuses doing? Well, they're creating these homes for animals. And so in this game, you're going to have these little animals in your home that score. And anyways, it's like, she does kind of a very similar thing that I do, where it's kind of thinking about these things in real life and how they work.
Oh, I'm excited to try it out, especially because I'm from Arizona, so big fan. Granted, I have accidentally been knocked into a cactus before.
Oh, no.
Very painful.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Not a fun camping trip.
That sounds so painful. But yeah, I especially think for like Arizona people and stuff, obviously for anyone, but like, if you're from Arizona, I think you'll love it too, because you know these cacti very well.
Very cool. Thank you, everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 149, Jewel Box. And Zach, I really appreciate you coming on the show and also listening to the show. But for anyone trying to find you online, where can you be found?
Yeah, so I'm the main person that runs our Instagram and Facebook and stuff. And so you can reach me on our Instagram at LoveMoreGames. You can also reach out to us on our website, www.lovemoregames.com, or just send me an email, Zach@lovemoregames.com.
Sweet. And I've been your host. I'm Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find me on my personal social media, you can check out my Instagram under Token Gamer, spelled GAYMER. And then, of course, Game Design Unboxed has an Instagram and a TikTok. So if you're trying to watch those fun videos that I've been putting out, do that. And if you're looking for my personal designs, go on BoardGameGeek or DMRCreativeGroup.com. And I hope everyone enjoyed listening to this episode. I appreciate you, Zach, for being on. And I really want to check out this game in person. It looks and sounds beautiful.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I look forward to meeting you, Danielle, and hopefully I'll be able to teach it to you.
Heck yeah.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out NoDirectionPodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out AllPlay at Let'sAllPlay.com. Join us next time.